All right. It might seem a bit tangentially related at best, but behavioral studies have shown that for some reason humans like things in threes. Three-course meals, three-piece suits, first, second, and third place, that sort of thing. And this helped explain our addiction, you might say, to TLAs or three-letter acronyms. And that's the link to tonight's topic, because on this call we're going to introduce you to yet another three-letter acronym, and this one is GIA, a government industry agreement. In this case, on biosecurity. So, we're going to discuss what the proposed GIA for biosecurity means for beef and lamb farmers, and we're going to talk about how they can have their say on that proposal. Now, as usual in our neoliberal economy, when a government wants to agree something with industry, the matter of funding comes up. So, we'll have a bit of a talk about that and what it's going to cost and how it's proposed to raise that funding if it's needed and how it will be determined when it's needed. So we're joined tonight by two senior staff at Beef and Lamb New Zealand to talk about our proposed GIA and to answer any questions. Dave Harrison is General Manager for Policy and Advocacy. So we'll start with you, Dave. Tell us, what does that role actually entail? What do you do in your day job?
So look, policy and advocacy, we have a team of 7 or 8 people that cover a whole range of areas, notably, I guess, the environment, animal welfare, trade policy is a big thing for us, and obviously the subject of tonight's call, which is the biosecurity area.
All right. And you've been with Beef and Lamb New Zealand for a wee while before this. What did you tell us about some of your background roles?
So I've been with Beef and Lamb New Zealand for 10 years in September, it was, which was a bit of a surprise. And prior to that, I started up at Beef and Lamb as the company lawyer, and I did that for a couple of years, and also operating sort of meat board activity. But the past 6 or 7 years, I've spent over in Europe running our European office. So that's been involved in trying to get a free trade negotiation started with the European Union, as well as kind of getting to know the farmer groups over there and trying to, sort of build some relationships so that they don't pull our product off the shelves, basically.
And look, you're Beef and Lamb New Zealand's current social media star because you've been all over the place standing beside our brand new Prime Minister in Vietnam. So what were you doing over there? That a junket or were you actually doing some serious work over there?
You junk it. No, actually. So we have, look, it's a new government, and so it's really important for us to lay some markers in terms of what's important to us and what our priorities are. So we had an opportunity to get over there and start to talk about the Trans-Pacific Agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, as it was being negotiated in the context of in the margins of the APEC meetings. So it was really important for us, A, to get TPP over the line because there's some really huge gains to be had there, particularly in terms of our beef access to Japan. And if you look at, at the moment, since 2015, the Australians have had a tariff advantage for us, over us in Japan. And since that period, cumulatively, the value of their exports has grown by $1 billion, while over that same 2 year period, ours has dropped by 30 million. So there's actually some massive opportunities in Japan that we're missing out on. So we needed to reinforce to the government how important that is. And it was also an opportunity with the new government to get to know the Trade Minister and to get to know the Prime Minister a little bit more. And so that when people think about trade and when people think about agricultural trade, they think about us.
Good. Well, there was actually two reasons for that question. A is to help you set the scene about what you do, but I'm going to come back to that a wee bit later about with the new government we've got in place as well. So also on the line, technology willing, and I hope he's still there, is Beef and Lamb New Zealand's Manager for Technical Policy, Chris Houston. Are you still there, Chris?
Yes, hi.
Ooh, excellent. Okay, look, same deal. What do you do for beef and sheep meat farmers, Chris?
I've been with Beef and Lamb for 7 years now. My background is in science and animal disease control with both the UK and the New Zealand government. And since joining Beef and Lamb, I look after a broad variety of things: animal welfare, traceability, biosecurity, and the like. So yes, that's what I do.
So, look, specific example, you've been pretty busy lately with the most recent biosecurity issue and probably one of the most significant ones we've had for a while, Mycoplasma bovis. Give us a bit of an outline, not so much the specifics around M. bovis, but tell us sort of what your role is there, how you work on behalf of beef and sheep farmers.
Oh, so I guess I'm our point person for response with MPI, and so a whole suite of activities there, sort of engaging with MPI on the technical aspects of the response, liaising between our farmers and our board and our senior management and MPI, having input into sort of options analysis about, you know, control policies and sort of where the future of the response might go, and just generally taking care of inquiries that come to us from farmers about how the response is tracking.
Excellent. Thanks, Chris. So now that just sets the scene, ladies and gentlemen, that's why these two gentlemen are on the call tonight. Their roles are intimately involved with what this GIA is all about, as you'll hear as we go along. So I think, Dave, you're going to give us basically, to start us off, the 2 or 3 minute elevator pitch. What's this government industry agreement all about? Why has it come about? What's what's the process, and what will be the outcomes if it goes as you think it might?
Okay. Thanks, Aaron. Look, it's fair to say it's been a really long story with GIA, and it's been over 10 years because, as I was saying before, I've been with Beefland for 10 years, and I started off my first involvement with GIA was in a previous job. So this has been going on for quite some time, but anybody, you know, everybody knows that like a situation like a foot and mouth disease is devastating to our industry. But even sort of beyond that, if you look at the impact of an M. bovis, or if you look at the, you know, the impacts of even a velvet leaf, we're facing we have potential sort of disaster scenarios, but we're also facing like a continual drip, drip, drip of many different smaller biosecurity incursions that we're increasingly needing to manage. So what GIA is all about is really a negotiation on how decisions are made about what to respond to and what to prepare for, and when you are responding, how do you respond to a pest or a disease, and where it differs from what happens at the moment is you have a response, and the government, the Ministry of Primary Industry, will go and talk to Treasury and say, you know, can I have some money for this response? Treasury will say yes or no, and in deciding how to manage it, they will talk to industry, get industry's views, but the government will make the decision. And so what's really different about what's being proposed here is that instead of us being consulted, we'd be sitting around the decision-making table and deciding how to respond and how hard to go, which is, you know, quite a significant change in terms of controlling our destiny around biosecurity, which is a massive risk for us, you know, as I've alluded to. But there is a pound of flesh to be had for that. And so in exchange for those decision-making rights, we need to commit to be paying a limited amount to a response. And when I say a limited amount, I mean that, you know, if we have a response, we agree caps on how much we're willing to pay, and how much you're willing to pay is based on divisions between, you know, putting at least 50% of the cost to MPI, and then splitting costs amongst the various impacted industries, and only having to pay if you decide that you want to participate in a response. So as much as it is a pay to say situation, you also get to decide whether you want to pay and have that say. So, you know, for us, we think it's a really great chance to take control over one of the more significant risks to our sector. Look, it does come with its downsides in that you have to pay. But the flip side of that is that MPI are in the process of putting in regulations now where they're going to require industries to pay even if they don't say. So when you look at it with that background, and when you look at how important it is for us as a sector to be able to control this risk, you know, for me, it seems like a really sensible thing to do. But at the end of the day, it depends on what farmers think about it, because we can't enter into this agreement unless it's something that farmers support.
Thanks, Dave. Look, so we know the status quo, what it's been up to, and you talked about that. I want to talk a wee bit about the drive for change. But what does happen if, for whatever reason, we decide not to go into a GIA? The government can simply take that money anyway, or...
Not at the moment, but that's certainly what they've planned. Is they, look, the government is looking to be able to recover some of the costs around biosecurity one way or the other. And the proposals that are on the table and the clear direction we've been given is that the government is going to recover from people whether they sign or not. The difference is whether you have the say and whether you have that influence and whether you're able to choose how to direct resources into the responses that matter to you.
So we talked about an example like foot and mouth. We've just Chris did a bit about Imbovis as an example, but biosecurity risks or incursions don't only affect animals. There's other industries, and obviously we've seen with PSA and the kiwifruit industry. Who else is involved in this GIA?
So there's a lot of involvement already particularly from the sort of horticulture sector. So as you say, yeah, the likes of the kiwi fruit industry, in our particular sector, in the pastoral sector. So we already have the meat industry associations involved representing processes. We have Pork New Zealand involved representing the pork industry. We have the Dairy Companies Association of New Zealand representing the dairy processing industry. And the mandate-seeking process that we've gone through is ourselves alongside Dairy New Zealand and alongside the deer industry New Zealand going and seeking a collective mandate from all of our farmers. And we think that, you know, collectively we think this is a good thing to be doing. And we want to put that value proposition to farmers together and see what they think is the best interest for their respective sectors. Mm-hmm.
So you talked there about those primary production sectors around animal production. In the hort sectors and those sorts of other primary production sectors, have they already signed up? What's their status?
Yeah, look, they've already signed up. So yeah, I think there is 14 sectors that have already signed up of varying sizes. And at the moment, they are sitting around the table deciding how this arrangement works, if you like. But at the moment, they're not having to pay because they've had an assurance from MPI that they won't have to pay until MPI has a mechanism in there to be able to start recovering to people who don't sign. Mm-hmm. But they're already around the table talking about the stuff, helping the government set priorities, and we're not.
Okay. I mean, in essence, it's if you're not at the table, you're on the menu sort of situation.
Exactly. Yeah.
But look, it's a government industry agreement. You talk about all the industries, and you talk about how long this has been going, but also that coincides with the fact we've had a national-led government over that 9 years. We've got a new government with new views on things and some big changes going on. Does that change the situation here?
Well, there's no indication that that's the case. It's early days for the new government, but to be honest, I think, from what I understand from Minister O'Connor, he's a very strong supporter of biosecurity, and he's a very strong supporter of industry being involved in the biosecurity program. So, look, there's nothing to indicate that there's any change of sentiment around GIA with the change of government.
And look, it's an unfortunate incident, but it's perhaps fortunate for this conference call that we have had a significant biosecurity incursion for the livestock sector in Imbovis. And this may be one, Chris, you want to answer on, but we've talked about the situation the way it used to be, the plan. What would be different? I mean, would Imbovis, as we've seen, be trigger a levy or the livestock farmers having to pay under the GIA? Had it already been in place?
I guess part of the answer to that, Aaron, is it kind of depends on where we'd be at in terms of the how the cost-sharing negotiation would go with both among the industries and with the government. So the industries as part of the GIA have negotiated with MPI a matrix which describes the different cost shares that would apply in different circumstances. And it's probably a bit too complicated to go into in detail on this call, but it broadly says that the more benefit that an industry or the public sector has, the greater share they would pay of costs, which makes sense. But in a situation where outbreaks are bigger than or of significant scale, then that trends towards a higher Crown contribution.
Yep.
So in principle, then our sector in an Imbovis outbreak in future would be expected to pay some share of costs. But what that looks like would be kind of determined on a range of factors. Principally, relative farm gate value and the degree of impact on the sector relative to others.
No, that's good. That's the point. I think people would want to know. It's not a one size fits all here. It is prorated. So sheep and beef farmers aren't going to end up paying for a horticultural incursion, for example. It's specific to the industry. And
no,
sorry, carry on, Chris.
Well, that's right. No, I was about to say that, you know, GIA. That's one of the questions we had today actually from a farmer was about whether GIA applies to plant pests and pasture pests, and it does. But being in GIA gives us control over that liability. And so for example, there's pests that can affect other industries which produce crops which on occasions may be fed to sheep or beef cattle. And the, you know, while we're in GIA, on behalf of the sector, we can make decisions about the relative amount of resources we'd want to devote to essentially other industries' priorities, which is a crucial benefit you get from being in GIA that being outside would not deliver.
Mm-hmm. And it's still, so it's not just, you know, animals or plants, there's still, from what you were saying there, a level of refinement within that. It would be, you know, cattle, whether they're beef cattle or dairy cattle, it could be differentially applied.
So if you take the example of M. bovis, we've part of the work we've done throughout this response is to try and get the best technical information from both the literature and experts from other countries that are familiar with this disease, and try and characterize what that would actually mean for the country were it to become established, because analysis like that is really important for determining the cost-benefit equation that the government ultimately makes on whether it wishes to invest in full-scale eradication of this or not. Mm-hmm. And so what that's shown us in the case of M. bovis is that the impacts on dry stock production are substantially lower because of the way we farm than they are in the dairy industry. So, you know, M. bovis is an example where we would expect, because of the degree of impact on dairy relative to beef, where there'd be a higher cost share for dairy than beef farmers.
Great, thanks. All right, so look, in practice, this is a... not optional, but the GIA provides the option to impose to recover costs. It's on an incident basis. Something, the levy doesn't just get applied automatically. It would have to be for something to happen, then it gets triggered.
That's what our proposal is. Mm-hmm. And so the GIA that is neutral as to how you mm-hmm. you pay you meet your commitments. But what our proposal is that. In terms of sort of being prepared for biosecurity and the money that already, you know, your commodity levies already cover for biosecurity, we'd maintain that as business as usual. Mm-hmm. But what we're looking at is enable to allow us to be able to contribute to a response activity or to a significant readiness activity, like something like maintaining a vaccine bank mm-hmm. for foot and mouth disease, those sorts of things. Then we're not allowed to spend our Commodity Levies Act on mm-hmm. those sorts of things. Our commodity levies, sorry. So we would have to raise a levy under the Biosecurity Act to be able to do it. And so what we're proposing is a levy with a maximum of 5 cents a head per sheep, 45 cents a head per cattle beast, set at zero, and could be moved up and down within that range if and when required. Mm.
Yeah. So if something happened, M. bovis Mark II or something worse,
yep.
you could trigger it. Why not, though... that's sort of not quite, but almost ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. Something happens, then we raise the money. Why not effectively amortize it and say, look, let's start soldering away money now. It'll spread the cost over time. It'll be less per animal per year rather than do it as one off and save that money and have it in the bank when we need it.
Very good question, Aaron. Look, and that's something that we could decide to do in the future if that's what farmers felt that they wanted to do. We've kind of come into this thinking that we've set our levy rates at what we think is probably a worst case scenario for a single response mm-hmm. And paying back that response in a year. So we're looking at, so it's based on a medium scale foot and mouth disease incursion, which is the highest rate of foot and mouth disease incursion we'd have to contribute to, and paying that all back within 12 months. So look, there's opportunity within that sort of framework to pay it back over a longer period, or if we wanted to build up a war chest, we could build up a war chest, but we'd talk to farmers before we decided to do that, I think.
So that, just go over those levy rates or the potential levy rates, and they are the worst case scenario, the maximum, not necessarily what it automatically will be.
That's exactly right. So we're saying like a maximum of 5 cents a head per sheep, 45 cents a head for cattle beast, and 2.5 million a year maximum.
Okay.
2.5 million a year would clear our costs based on NZIER analysis of a medium scale FMD response, kind of 50 odd affected farms within 12 months. And so we can extend that, we can negotiate how long we pay it back and all sorts of things. So it's it is a worst case.
Yep. And in practice, that money comes to Beef and Lamb, but then it's passed on to government, MPI or something like that, or not going to be MPI, but the equivalent there, right?
No, Ministry of Ag, I guess. But no, that's exactly what happens is basically they foot the bill, and then at the end of the incursion, it all gets mopped up subject to the individual caps of liability that people accept. And so those caps, so every time you decide to that you're going to have an agreement around responding to a disease, you agree a cap, and that's the total amount that you can be forced to pay or asked to pay in a response or readiness exercise related to that disease or pest.
Look, and then the obvious question, and I know you guys have thought about this one, there's money sitting there from the old reserves from the meat board that was farmers assumed was there for biosecurity issues and dealing with that. Why are we using that, not just using the levy? Why we need a levy, why not just use those reserves? Are you going to answer, Chris?
Oh, sorry, yes. So that's true. There is that contingency reserve that's looked after by the meat board, Aaron, but the management and the use policy statement that goes with that fund is quite clear that it's not to be used for disease control and eradication or preparedness even. That fund exists very specifically for rebuilding customer preference and confidence in New Zealand products should we face a crisis. So, for example, were we to get something like FMD or BSE, then there would be a need to restore the confidence of consumers in markets that our product was safe and wholesome to eat, and then that's what that money is very specifically ring-fenced for.
Okay, so that's in addition to this GIA funding, there could be still a call on reserves.
Yes, but it's for a different thing, though. So the call on the reserves is for risk market restoration, not for the response.
Yeah, but this GIA doesn't supplant that. This is the two are separate, but cumulative, effectively.
Yeah.
All righty. So again, that's for after something happens. The cost of dealing with it, the cost of building up again market demand for New Zealand products. But what about the fence at the top of the cliff stuff? I mean. Is any of this money, or it can't go, but what about putting more money to stop these things getting here in the first place?
Yeah.
Border control.
You go, Chris.
We've had quite a lot of feedback already in this consultation, and a lot of the farmers have raised that very issue about, well, what about the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff is the analogy many have used. GIA is very specific in terms of the contractual nature of it. It applies to preparedness and response to disease incursions or exotic organisms that are not already here. So it can't be used for controlling things like BVD, which are already here and the industry may in future wish to do something about. It's very specifically response and readiness for exotic disease incursions. The trade agreements that New Zealand's entered into include a thing called the SPS chapter, sanitary and phytosanitary chapter, and under basically our agreements with trading partners, we are as a country required to have science-based standards, and it's considered inappropriate for industries to effectively buy influence into what those standards look like. It's very clear that they need to be science-based. And if you think that, in terms of analogous situations overseas, there are a number of sort of competing producers who would be quite interested in setting the terms of trade into which our products into markets may enter. So we understand why the government says that the GIA is very specifically excludes input into border measures for that very reason. Reciprocity in trade in terms of science-based standards is something that's vital for supporting our continued export into premium markets. That's the formal contractual side of how GIA stacks up. It's also true that setting standards may be outside it, but transparency around performance of the border and other standards to the standards that are set is a different issue. And so as GIA signatories, we believe that and other industries also are strongly motivated to participate in the influence that we can have in requiring transparency of those standards at the border. And in addition to that, participation in conversations with MPI about horizon scanning for whatever hazards and threats may be out there, and taking early action on sort of collectively spotting what those risks might be and thinking about how we can best manage them.
Look, I just want to, we've actually had one question that came in. It was fairly detailed, so I'm going to precede it a wee bit, but it builds on one of the things you touched on there, which was about existing biosecurity issues, not incursions like MBOVIS, but you mentioned BVD, Yonis is another one that, potentially it is animal productivity issues and potentially, human health and welfare type issues. This GIA can't be used from that, from what you were saying, but yeah, what do we do about some of those things without here already and having an impact and potentially are a risk if, as keep mentioning around Yonis, if there's some sort of human health impact or becomes a scare around that. I don't know whether...
So...
Who wants to answer that one?
I can have a crack at that. So
Dave's
the,
nodding, yeah.
the GIA could be used... The GIA could be used if those pests or diseases that are already here were having new impacts, or if significant control tools became available to allow their control. Okay. So there is some grey area around using GIA to deal with existing pests, but in the main it's focused on exotic diseases. But as you say, there are things that are already here, and the industry has looked at, what's the business case for collective effort to deal to them.
That's interesting. Because the question that came in did specifically mention, a new vaccine for Yonis or something like that. So it's feasible that this could be applied to that.
Yeah, in that instance, then that is within the scope of what GIA can involve.
Good. Now look, going to come back a wee bit to around some specifics around process, but one of the things that's mentioned, and I don't think we've really covered it yet, is a livestock sector council. So is this just another quango that farmers are going to end up paying for, or what's, and that's not something that gets triggered when there's a biosecurity incursion, I understand, that's something that's there all along. Who's going to be on that, what's its role going to be, and who's paying for that?
Good question. No, it's not another quango. It is like a, it's a body made up of the livestock sector people who've signed up to GIA plus MPI. So it is just, essentially it's like a board of their representatives. Everybody meets their own costs in attending that. There is a wee bit of cost associated, well, there will be a wee bit of cost associated with being part of GIA in terms of, supporting the overall secretariat, which is shared amongst everybody who signs up to GIA. At the moment, there's no cost associated, but in future, that's probably quite likely, but it's not huge. So the Livestock Sector Council is basically just the forum where all of the livestock sector parties can get together and talk about what the priorities are, talk about how we respond to a pest or disease, and talk about how we get ready for ones that we can see on the horizon.
And that's a operational level type role, so that's the sort of thing you would be involved in, or you might delegate to Chris to go along to?
Yeah.
Just another job?
Well, at the moment, we've kind of left it open in terms of, there's a possibility that it could be at a board level. But it probably does depend on the nature of things that it's being called upon to decide. So it can be done at a level of myself or Chris. It really depends on, I guess, what's on the menu.
This is a major benefit from participating in GIA, although membership of the Livestock Sector Council doesn't actually require you to be a signatory, you can be invited, but it's the opportunity to sit around with the other industries and the many different parts of MPI regularly and talk about the breadth of biosecurity issues we face, which includes border standards and a whole spectrum of things that sit outside GIA formally, is a real opportunity in terms of just making sure that, you know, we're recognizing the different, you know, bits of intelligence the different industries are picking up, that we've got MPI, the different parts of the ministry, in one place where we can all have a more coordinated conversation, is a significant opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I just want to pick up on a couple of specific questions. We'll talk about later about all the resource material that's been produced to go alongside this podcast, one of which is the frequently asked questions, which has gone out to farmers.
It's on our website.
All right. And we'll add the link into that when we post this up on the website. But one of the questions in there was a really interesting one, is that meat processors have already signed up to the GIA. Mm. And obviously that means they're going to be putting funding in, which is going to come from indirectly or directly from farmers. So does that mean our meat farmers are paying twice? You're taking big breaths when I ask these questions.
That's actually been a little bit of a fractious issue, to be honest with you. But look, no, so the meat processing sector has signed up as representative of meat processing interests. And mm-hmm. so when they provide a levy or when they provide a contribution for an incursion response, it'd be to meet the share of the value or the share of the impact of that pest or disease on the processing sector, mm-hmm. not on the farming side. And that'd have to be funded from the processing sector, not from the farming sector. Mm-hmm. Now, look, value chains being what they are, I can understand the argument that somebody is paying anyway, but it wouldn't be a direct levy on farmers for mm-hmm. processors to participate.
And so, and broadly in the same vein, I mean, we've got mixed cropping farmers who grow crops and run livestock. We've got dairy farmers who mainly produce milk but also produce some beef. Mm-hmm. They're arguably going to be paying a GIA levy on, depending on what it was, on several, you know, specific, rather than just one. Is that because we're, you know, things are prorated by sector and by product and so on?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So like the levies are based on the value of the, you know, the farm gate value of relative products. And so look, a dairy farmer may pay a beef portion and a dairy portion, but that reflects the fact that their farm business income is part beef and part dairy. Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right, look, let's get into some specifics around process. This is open at the moment. Just to remind people, what's the process from here and when are you closing off this sort of consultation?
So from here, yeah, look, we through to the like, consultation is open until December the 6th. Mm-hmm. And so we're really encouraging everybody to, you know, have a read of the documents and understand them, because it is quite a big decision, I think. And look, we think it is the right one to make, but it's not really our choice because we're not the ones who are signing up to that commitment. Mm-hmm. So by December 6th, you know, please have a look at. There's been a packet that's been sent to all sheep and beef farmers on our CRM. Mm-hmm. There is information available on the Beef and Lamb New Zealand website where you can read the summary document, mm-hmm. a more comprehensive document around what GIA means, as well as the Q&As that you mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, Aaron. So, you know, if you please have a read. And then with that, there's information about how you can give us your views. And so you can give us your views online. If you've got your pack in the mail, you can. There's a free post that you can send your views into us on. Or, you know, if you want to contact Beef and Lamb New Zealand, you know, ask for Chris Houston or Dave Harrison, and we're more than happy to take your feedback over the phone.
Yep. So if people haven't received the material in the mail and don't want to see it on the internet, they can just give us a call on the 0800 number.
Yep.
0800 Beef Lamb, and they'll get one sent out free of charge.
And we can do that too. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Now, what's the process though? This isn't a formal referendum as such, it's a consultation. So, it doesn't have to pass a certain margin, but what happens if feedback is one way, but can Beef and Lamb still go ahead with it, even if the feedback is no?
If the feedback was no, we wouldn't go ahead with it. Okay. Like, that's, you know, bottom line, I think. Look, if the feedback is no, A, the minister shouldn't agree to allow us to sign, but B, it's, if we don't have the support from the farmers, then there's no point in doing this.
But this isn't a, there's no formal voting as such, it's just you're going to base that on the feedback you get either informally or through the submission type process?
Yeah, absolutely. And so all feedback, whether it's through the phone or through email or whatever, is going to be consolidated into a single document. So we'll be able to have a pretty clear picture of what the feedback's been. And then we'll understand whether the feedback is generally positive, much like any kind of policy development process.
Did you want to add something?
Aaron, I was just going to say that we've had some, you know, I was emailing a farmer today who's asked some questions about, will the farmers get to see what other farmers had to say about this? And that's absolutely our intention. So we are currently gathering the feedback as it comes in and pulling it all together, and our intention is to summarize that and then make that available for everybody to have a look at. It's sort of in parallel with the process where we'll be putting it to our board for their consideration.
The bottom line though is, barring some significant change with the new government, which seems unlikely, farmers are going to pay for this stuff one way or another. It's just how much control they have over that process.
Yes,
that's
not the reason.
No, I agree with that. But that is the bottom line is, one way or another, it's not the sole reason. But
that's what MPI.
That is a reality, Aaron. The other major benefit here, I talked about the participation in the Livestock Sector Council, which is sort of a collaborative forum. I mean, that's a, you know, that benefit's not a major benefit here, relative to some of the others. The issue that you control your own or sector's liability through participation in GIA in a way you can't if you're outside is really important. And the other that we perhaps haven't talked enough about is the benefit of minimum commitments. As part of the agreement that we've been working on with MPI on what the world would look like for MPI, there's a whole series of minimum commitments which form part of the commitments all signatories signing the deed make. Mm-hmm. But for our for the livestock industries, we've gone into much more detail about the sort of capability and preparedness arrangements that MPI and the industries as well would need to maintain on an ongoing basis. And I see that as a very significant benefit here. For me, it's the major win in terms of, you know, why GIA is a good idea. Those minimum commitments set out a whole raft of things which the government and industries are accountable to each other for maintaining. And what that effectively means is all of the core capability that would be required to manage major livestock diseases has been agreed that will be maintained into the future by the government at a level which is fit for purpose. And that's a very significant aspect of this. It was only a few years ago where we had an Auditor General's report which suggested perhaps everything wasn't right in terms of the preparedness arrangements and other aspects of the biosecurity machinery that the government maintains. And so we hope to achieve, as part of joining GIA, that we can lock that in, and that will be something that we never have to revisit seriously again, with the exception of continually going over and just kind of routine health checks to make sure everything's as it should be.
Great. No, that's good. Now, look, my point there wasn't, look, it's a, this is coming anyway, or we've been blackmailed into it. There are positive reasons, just as you have explained, but just that an overwhelming no response or so on, and this isn't necessarily going to change the course that the ship's taking at the moment. It's just whether we're got a hand on the rudder, to stretch the analogy.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to pay, that's for sure.
Right. Hey, look, just before we wrap up, just one thing, Chris. So we've talked a bit about this and we got on to existing biosecurity and border control and those sorts of things, but I know something that's sort of dear to your heart that's kind of related to this is farmers don't need to sit and wait and just spend the money or put the levy in place for when things happen. There's things they can do day to day on their farm. Do you want to We've got biosecurity resources and advice for farmers around how they can actually take action on their own farm. Do you want a good time to highlight those about what people can do anyway, not just sit back and say I've paid a levy and therefore it's all taken care of?
Yeah, look, that's right, we do. And, you know, GIA provides an opportunity for potentially working a bit more closely with other industries and MPI on this sort of thing. So, you know, look, biosecurity on farms is important, and you know, this is prime, the business case really for maintaining good on-farm biosecurity does revolve around diseases and weeds and pests that are already here. The fact is that farms that are taking care of good biosecurity would make us much more resilient would a exotic disease get here, because the degree of silent spread that would occur between farms before the disease is noticed would be significantly smaller. But exotic disease outbreaks happen very rarely. And so the key benefits from on-farm biosecurity are really about managing the impacts of those diseases already here. A major risk for livestock diseases is purchasing live animals from places where you're uncertain of the health status of the animal. So having a good handle on stock you're buying and asking questions of the vendor about the health status is important. Quarantining them when they arrive, maintaining animal health plans and vaccinations also limit any impacts from diseases that can be vaccinated for. Looking at your animals regularly, it sounds simple, and for many farmers it's second nature, but perhaps they don't appreciate just how important continual vigilance for noticing, you know, what's not normal, and perhaps getting the vet in to deal to it early before something develops into a major issue. You know, this isn't all about animal diseases. You know, bringing in forage or machinery onto your farm is a great way of introducing weeds and plant pests, pasture pests. So, you know, similarly there, paying close attention to risk movements onto your farm in terms of machinery and feeds another thing people can do. Maintaining their fences so that stock from properties where they're not, you know, the neighbors, if they're not certain what the disease status is like, you can control your own farm, but if your fences aren't good and your stock are effectively mixing with the neighbors, then you're sharing their risk. So, you know, there's a whole raft of do's and don'ts around disposal of dead stock, managing pests and vermin on the farm. Possums are something that Kiwi farmers are particularly aware of, and the risks they can pose. And just thinking about M. bovis, which I know is an exotic disease, but keeping very good records, your ASD forms and NATE records, can be particularly helpful for responses. And we've been doing our best throughout M. bovis to help everybody recognize that, yes, NATE's copped a bit of flak as part of this response, because not everybody's been doing what they should have been doing and keeping good records. But MPI has told us that where farmers have maintained really good records of movements and not just of animals, but, you know, vet visits and what have you, that's made tracing activities and trying to get ahead of the disease and limit, you know, where it may go next, has made that much easier. So the importance of good record keeping would be the other thing I'd like to stress there.
Brilliant. And if the listeners couldn't tell, this is something Chris is A, extremely well informed on, and B, very passionate about. So if you want to find out more and more detail or a record of all the things you just talked about, it's Beef and Lamb New Zealand have their, I think they're called the Dry Stock Biosecurity Guidelines, Chris, and the they've been tested, if you like, lately with the M. bovis response, and found to be a fairly comprehensive and useful document.
Sorry, Aaron, I missed part of that. Did you just ask me a question about our biosecurity guidance?
Yeah, I was just saying our biosecurity guidelines sort of contain in depth what you've just spoken about there, and the experience in the real world has proven just recently with M. bovis that they it's a pretty good document. The information in it is valuable and useful and accurate. A fair question?
Yes, that's right.
Good. Excellent. All right. Look, I'm just looking at the time. We said we'd go for about 45 to 50 minutes, and that's coming up right now. So I think, unless there's anything else, Dave, you want to remind people about or comment on there?
No, just, you know, just reinforce again, please read the documents and please let us know what you think.
Yep. So the documents should have arrived in your mailbox if you're a sheep and beef farmer on our, as Dave called, our CRM, our database of sheep and beef farmers. If not, they're there on our website if you want to go that way, or give us a call, 0800 Beef Lamb, email us at our there's actually a proper contact email for it, I remember off the top of my head. So, yep, GIA@beeflambnz.com, and we'll put those contacts in the podcast listing that's up there as well. So, or talk to your local extension manager and they'll sort you out as well. We want everybody to be aware of what we're talking about here and have their say if they wish to. So on that note, thank you very much, Chris, at the other end on the Skype line, which hopefully has worked well for people, and to Dave Harrison here in the Wellington office, and good night.
Thanks, Aaron.